We sometimes think of history as something from the distant past or written in a book, but every day, if you think about it, you walk on top of history without giving it a lot of thought. Our guests this morning include Chelsea Rose from the SOU Lab of Anthropology and MJ Daspit, a local author who's been doing research into the location and history of Peter Britt's early vineyards in southern Oregon. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
It's great to have you here. Well, this has been a little bit of a detective launch and work, hasn't it, as well, to find. We knew that he was the first person to have vineyards in the Rogue Valley, right, that we know of. But where? That's the mystery.
Right. He is credited with being the first commercial winery, mainly because he got into trouble with the Internal Revenue in 1873 and was forced to declare himself a business by the name of Valley View Vineyard, mm-hmm. and thereby come clean and pay up his business license fees and his taxes. So we know from that he was dealing very early in commercial wine. And actually, his vineyard goes back farther to the site that Chelsea was working on, which started at the site of today's Brit Festival.
And that's right. He had just a small vineyard around his home, didn't he?
So Peter Britt moved to Jacksonville in 1852 or 4. I can't remember which one, but off the top of my head. But he lived on the hill above Jacksonville, and he started experimenting with everything. He had vineyards. He bought grapes really early. He even had banana palm tree. He had all sorts of stuff he was trying to grow, raised bees. So he was really an agricultural entrepreneur and innovator, which really, his legacy really had an important impact on the valley. And so when we did archaeology there in 2009 and 2010, we were looking at, his homestead and what kind of activities were taking place there. And we found a lot of evidence associated with his early winemaking activities, which was pretty exciting.
Now, was it at that time that you found some grape seeds, or was that later?
Well, yes and no. So, yes, we did recover the grape seeds from that excavation, but we didn't know they were in there until we sent a bunch of samples. A descendant of Peter Britt's, a great nephew, donated some money to support having a botanical analysis done on some of the soil samples we recovered from the archaeology. And within there, we found some grape seeds, which were pretty exciting. I think there's a half dozen of them. One of the things that we were also surprised is there wasn't a lot of other plant remains in there. So we thought he is this horticulturalist. There's plants everywhere. There'd be a lot of plants, but there weren't. And so what we think is that it's actually still really interesting because Peter Britt is composting. He's actively managing his compostable waste in a way that other early homesteaders aren't at that time, because he knows that it has value to his gardens.
Every time you turn around with Peter Britt, he's like a Renaissance man,
isn't he?
Right. Yeah. Well, that's interesting. MJ, now, as you were trying to look for the commercial vineyard, you had to really go back to some old documents, some journals, some platting, and tell us about that whole process.
Yeah, I began by looking at a couple of sources that referred to the larger vineyard on the north side of Jacksonville. And one of those is Alan C. Miller's biography of Peter Britt that came out as a thesis, his master's thesis, which is amazing because it's an incredibly detailed amount of work and explicitly done research. Anyway, he referred to this vineyard, and also our local viticultural historian, Willard Brown, Dr. Brown, also referred to it. And I think that the most recognized source of their references to this site was the Oregon State Board of Agriculture study done in 1890 on the resources of Southern Oregon. And this is where all the vineyard owners of that time were listed. There were 17 of them, and 10 of them were right around Jacksonville, and they were pretty much clustered together in this site that was once again referred to as north of Jacksonville. Now, Peter Britt's diaries are really kind of interesting because they are, to a large degree, the ones that are devoted to his winemaking are about the sales. He kept sales line by line, you know, and sold for about 50 cents a gallon and recorded every time he made a sale. And I guess this is because he got burned by the IRS. But anyway, the there wasn't a lot of information there that we could use, but every once in a while he would say, got grapes from the farm or the ranch, as opposed to got grapes from the garden. Mm. And the garden we know is what Chelsea was looking at, the site on the top of the hill. But the garden was different from the ranch. And so the first time he made that notation, got grapes from the ranch, was in 1872, about this time of year. And so it occurred to me that he must have bought that tract of land sometime before 1872. And fortunately, the Jackson County Recorder's Office has the old deeds from way back, starting around the 1850s. And I was able to actually find some 47 Brit deeds that were, you know, they're listed chronologically, and only one of those deeds was for a rural plot of about 100 acres, and it was purchased in 1870. All of his other big rural holdings were more like after 1872. So to me, that narrowed it down to this one tract. And so then I took the description, the legal description of the property, which is done in a terminology known as meets and bounds, which is, you know, such and such a township and section and range and all that,
right,
which is pretty, you know, pretty much Greek to me. And I took it to a cartographer located in Medford. I didn't even know we had those people around here, but we do. And he was able to plot it for me.
Wow.
And lo and behold, it turned out that this site is, you know, somewhere about a mile north of Jacksonville on the stage road between Tammy Lane and the old military road.
Okay.
So it's basically, if you're at Relic Winery and you look west and you see the hillside west of them, you're kind of like in the ballpark. That's kind of where it was. So that was what we did.
And you're lucky you had that much information, because a lot of the land, especially with mining and stuff I've looked at, when they talk about meets and bounds, it's like the oak tree with the three slash marks and the big rock on the corner. You know, there is no way you're finding that, whether you're a cartographer or not.
Yeah, we had some of those too. And the other thing that I think is so cool about the way we can research today is that all of these old deed books were photographed. Mm-hmm. And so all those records have been digitized, and you can basically sit home in your fuzzy slippers and pull those things up on your own computer at home, as long as you access it through the county website. And it's like magic, you know, boom, you're there. So it was a really good experience.
It's fun. Well, Chelsea Rose from the SOU Lab of Anthropology and MJ Daspit, a local author, are the ones doing this research on Peter Britt's early vineyards in southern Oregon. If you'd like to join the conversation, if you have some questions about that, or maybe you live in Jacksonville and you'd like to kind of go out and look at that area, you can join our conversation by calling 800-838-3760, or you can send us an email at jx@jeffnet.org. As you go forward with the research that you've done, what happens now that we know where that was? We don't have to pay the IRS some back taxes, do we? I hope not anyway.
No. The property today is held privately by a land developer. And it's pretty much in its native state. There hasn't been a lot of building on the site or anything like that. So that's really good. So it's just a question of, you know, finding the right approach to get permission to go and walk the site, see if there's anything there that we can still identify.
And we have lots of material to work with pertaining to the homestead itself and the early days of winemaking. There's in that case where he was busted by the IRS, there's a letter to the judge that Britt wrote, and it's basically, hey, I'm just a guy who grows grapes in my garden. Sometimes I make a little wine. It naturally ferments. My neighbors come over and fill jugs. Like, I'm not a winemaker, you know, and of course nobody bought it. But the early activities really were people kind of bringing growlers or jugs over and filling it up, like, you know, household employees and stuff. And we also know that he started to kind of move towards more professional winemaking on that plot as well, the main Britt Homestead in Jacksonville, and we found the remains of the building that had the 2,000-gallon redwood press tanks, I think they were, and also, you know, we excavated the basement where he had his first winemaking activities and found wine bottles and such. So there's a lot of more work we can do to understand that side of it using archaeology. Britt was not the only person doing these kind of experiments, but what we do have, why he's such a great case study, is because his life is so well documented. We not only have a lot of the stuff that came out of his house, there's diaries, there's so many documents that can help us kind of piece this together in a way that really lets us get to some pretty in-depth, detailed questions about what was it like to be one of the first people to grow, you know, imported wines in the region. So, or grapes, I mean.
Well, there must have been a lot of experimentation. You said he was trying to grow bananas also. So people were trying to figure out what would actually work here in the valley.
Yeah. And you know, one of the other fun things, another excavation we did at the property was we excavated the barn. The remains of the barn are under the ADA accessible walkway that takes you up into the Britt Festival. When they put that in, we found the barn. And we found some artifacts that kind of speak to that moment in time. Like, what will grow here? How do we extend the season? We found parts of bottles that had been modified so the bottoms were cut off and they were put over plant seedlings to help extend the season. So there's a lot of ways that he was experimenting. He had solariums attached to the house. You can see in photographs he brought stuff in and out seasonally. He covered stuff. So he was really going above and beyond to kind of push to see what could grow here and just by itself, what needed some tweaks. But there is a native grape here that does grow wild. So I think that was what first led him to believe there's no reason why these grapes can't grow and thrive.
There's also a book called The Grape Book that his son Emil Britt kept. It's dated from 1887, and this was held at the Southern Oregon Historical Society. And it lists all the different varieties of grapes that they were growing. And it comes to over 50 different varieties.
Wow.
And we also know from some of the correspondence that Britt had with a friend of his, Lewis Rothermill, who lived in San Jose, California, that he was actively importing different varieties from California. The thing that we don't have and that we wish we had is any sort of notation about what kind of wines they were making. All we know from Britt's very scanty journal entries is that all the red grapes got combined and it was just sold as native wine, you know, red native wine. So we can't really pin down a lot about what he was growing that's of interest to growers today. But we do know that he had a variety called Franc Pinot, also listed as Pinot Franc, which we associate with Pinot Noir. So there's this wonderful sense that we can reach all the way back, you know, to the late 19th century to see Pinot Noir in Oregon, which we love.
And that's where those grape seeds that we found come in. We want to get them. You can't identify them to varietal by visual clues, unfortunately. So we need to have DNA done on them. And we've been working, MJ's been helping us research how to do that so that we can see if it's possible to see what actual varietal it was. And then we would know for sure that this was being grown in I think the deposit those seeds came from is probably about 1870s. So it would be a pretty early, you know, it's also possible they were like a table grape, but
right.
But hopefully they're a wine grape.
Well, I was going to ask, and I think you've partially answered this question, like how important is his legacy to wine making in vineyards in our valley today?
Well, I think it is very important because there's a story that can be told here, and that's one of the big secrets of appealing to people as a wine region. You know, if you've got your new winery is set up on the outskirts of Jacksonville and you are looking to have a story that will interest people, visitors to your new winery, this is a great story. And they can actually go and see these sites just by traveling, you know, common roadways. Maybe someday we will be able to put up some signage, some historical, you know, markers that'll be accessible to people as they, you know, stop on the road, which would be really good. So it's all part of a process that we have to try to stimulate, I think, to get it going and to get people aware of, you know, how deep our roots are, so to speak, in the viticultural area here. So we're pretty excited about it.
We're talking about Peter Britt, but that extends a broader question. Have we done a lot or enough research on the history of vineyards in this area following, let's say, Peter Britt and up through the 20th century?
Well, I think it's a really fertile area. The only trouble that presents is that some of the records that Peter Britt left have not been translated. There are many, many diaries, and there are all these little tiny things that would fit in your pocket. Some of the journals are a bit larger, but the diaries that he kept day to day are very small. And they're in this German-Swiss dialect that nobody knows how to read anymore. And so it's really a difficult thing to see if there's much in there that's useful. A lot of it's weather observations, but there might be something else. We just haven't really gotten to read it all.
And there are other historians. Maureen Battistella has been doing a lot of work documenting the more modern wineries in the region, which go back, you know, decades as well. So there is a lot of efforts to kind of document this. Where Peter Britt gets interesting is when it comes to the historic period, he had such a big footprint on the valley. He came right at the beginning of the Western settlement in the region. And then after the gold basically wanes in Jackson County, agriculture is what puts us on the map. And he really had a big role in kind of innovating that, inspiring what could grow here. He had this Britt Park, it was called, his big show garden. And this was part of a Victorian effort to bring the parlor outside. It was a very fancy experience that people went there to the garden to see, like, you know, this fancy park. And that's now where the Britt Festival is. So that's his property, and his footprint on the valley is pretty large. And so it's an interesting kind of lens to look at this history and see, you know, how we got to now, how we got to all the different activities that are happening today in the valley and what the valley looks like. Peter Britt's story can really help us understand that.
Yeah, and another source that I was interested in when I was doing the book with Eric Weisinger, the Rogue Valley Wine book, was the contemporary newspapers, the Jacksonville newspapers of the day. And they touted the Rogue Valley as being comparable to Tuscany. This is supposed to be the new, you know, wine region that's going to eclipse everything, you know, and be like, you know, our premier region. Of course, the railroad coming through helped, and that meant that a lot of fresh fruit was getting shipped out, and we had lots of talk about that in the newspapers as well. But what happened to quash the whole viticultural endeavor was Prohibition. And we had Peter Britt writing letters to the newspaper as early as 1873 speaking against Prohibition. And later on, there was, I think in 1878, there was a ballot measure which was defeated. But eventually it was passed, and we actually got Prohibition in effect in Oregon 4 years before the rest of the nation. So we went dry in 1916. Britt died in 1905. His son kept the vineyards going and everything. We know that. But once the money, you know, fell out of the whole endeavor, pretty much, then it died off, and we went into the era of stone fruits and orchards much more.
And one of the other fun facts to go way back in the story that I always that always kind of stops me and makes me think about what did the West Coast look like in the 1850s? We know that Britt bought some of his earliest grape varietals from a peddler that came up from the missions in California. Mm-hmm. So this is really early in this Western landscape, not at all what it looks like today. So it's pretty interesting to see how, and those grapes came over from Europe. So these varietals that made it into Jackson County in the 1850s traveled a long way to get established here. And perhaps there's some, you know, grandchildren of those grapes still being grown in the valley. So I know that some of my friends that are winemakers always ask me, if you ever come across a really old grapevine, let us know. So maybe some listeners have one in their yard.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting that, you know, the this area is classified, well, my other job is a meteorologist. This area is classified as a northern Mediterranean climate. And so we're kind of on the edge of that. And it would just make sense, you know, when you start talking about Tuscany, you start talking about other places in Europe around the Mediterranean where they had been doing wine and grapes for a long, long time. It's not like we're forcing them to grow here. They do pretty well in our climate across this area. I was going to ask, did Peter Britt end up in Jacksonville because of the stagecoach line, or did he precede that?
Yeah, he came for gold. He came with a wagon, and the story kind of is that he came with a wagon and a $5 gold piece in his camera, and he tried to mine and was not very good at it. There's one story where he built kind of some of the equipment wrong, so, you know. But he got into packing and would run goods back and forth to Crescent City. And that was not a very fun job. So as soon as he could, he kind of set up shop as a photographer. And that, even though he was involved in basically everything he could think of, that was one constant. He was an artist and a photographer. And he had a studio going back to the 1850s that lasted until his death and was carried on by his son.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned that all of those different things that he was kind of involved in and did. We just have a few seconds left. MJ?
He was also the owner of a lumber mill in Phoenix. He was interested in trying to provide railroad ties when he thought the railroad was going to come through close by. So he had a finger in many pies.
We've been speaking today with Chelsea Rose from the SOU Lab of Anthropology and MJ Daspit, a local author who's been doing research into the location and history of Peter Britt's early vineyards in Southern Oregon. Thank you both for joining us this morning.